Hi, this is Ricky Gervais, and you're listening to Ross Owen on Black Sky Radio.
My next guest has appeared in too many shows to name them all, but he is best remembered for his role in Spinal Tap and currently as Chuck in Better Call Saul. Joining me now is Michael McKean. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
Now, first of all, I want to congratulate you on the success of Better Call Saul. I thought your acting, particularly in season two, was mind-blowing. When is it back?
Well, that's good. If I manage to blow one mind, I'm very happy.
Now, when is it back for a third season?
Well, I would look for it next year. We start shooting. We shoot the whole season out. It's our seasons are only 10 episodes long. So we shoot them out, and then they doll them up, and we put them out on the stands probably February, March.
Right.
So this summer, we're going to go back to Albuquerque and give it another shot.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait. Tell me this. Is Bob a fan of Laurel and Hardy?
Bob or Odenkirk?
Bob Odenkirk, yeah. Do you know if he's a fan?
Oh.
Coming from comedy?
Yes, of course he is. Listen, there is nobody in his right mind wouldn't be a fan of Laurel and Hardy unless they have no sense of humor. I make one exception. I know that Woody Allen doesn't like Laurel and Hardy, but he does have a sense of humor. I mean, he's a very funny man, but he's got this blind spot, I happen to know. And I think he's the only person I've ever met who doesn't care for Laurel and Hardy.
Wow.
They've been part of my life for so long. And, you know, I love them in a way that I don't love other movie actors or comedians. There's something about them that's, it's like they're part of my family. I've just known them since I was conscious.
Yes.
And it's a relationship that will never end until I do.
Can you remember how you were first introduced to Laurel and Hardy?
Well, I would say they didn't show the shorts on a regular basis, but occasionally, if one was home from school, as one could sometimes finagle it, there was a show called The Joe Franklin Show.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Franklin was a kind of a showbiz catch-all guy. He was a collector. He'd been around for a million years. He just died about two or three years ago. He was a very lovely man. I met him several times. And he was one of those guys who knew everything about old comedy and old showbiz. And he had this unbelievably cluttered office that was also his home base for TV. And he would occasionally show shorts, kind of on an irregular basis. And I got to see not only a few Laurel and Hardys, but also Charlie Chase,
yes.
Wheeler and Woolsey. I mean, really obscure people. Charlie Chase is not obscure particularly. He's a very, very talented guy. And, of course, did a lot of directing.
Yes, that's right. And his brother as well, of course. James Parrott.
Yes. That's right, James Parrott. So anyway, that was kind of the first little bits of them I saw, and then they started showing the features on Saturday afternoons here in America and in New York, and I got to watch them every week. They would have Pardon Us or Blockheads or Sons of the Desert or The Devil's Brother, which was actually just on TV yesterday.
That's my favorite one. That's my favorite Laurel and Hardy movie. Feature.
What, The Devil's Brother?
Yes.
Well, yeah, the bottling of the wine scene is awfully funny. There's some great stuff in that. I'm partial to Sons of the Desert and Blockheads myself. But there is, and I love all the shorts, too. Mm-hmm. I live in Cheviot Hills, which is just up the road from where Hal Roach Studios were.
Oh.
And in Cheviot, I was doing a film with David Paymer,
mm-hmm.
wonderful actor. And he said, you're a son of the desert, right? And I said, yeah, yeah. He says, and you live over in Cheviot Hills. That's where they built that house in The Finishing Touch. And I said, really? It's one of the silents? He said, yeah, yeah. So I went back and I watched this silent short, The Finishing Touch, and see if I could recognize anything. Now, Cheviot Hills is nice and green, and there's golf courses and everything. But it's a desert in 1928.
Mm.
And here are these guys, my favorite guys in the world, putting up this this house, building this house.
Wow.
And it's just kind of fascinating to live here. And Stan's house, the house that Stan lived in, is just up the road from us here.
That's right. So of course it is.
We're in Laurel and Hardy country.
That's fantastic. And you know what? So am I here in the UK. What Stan, his house in Glasgow is like 10 minutes from me. And also,
really?
James Finlayson is from Larbert, a place called Larbert in, near Falkirk, which is, again, 10 minutes in the other direction from me. And of course, Stan did his first stage performance here in Scotland in, at the Panopticon Theatre in Glasgow, which is still there and it's open. And the Sons of the Desert have their meetings there every month. They show Laurel and Hardy films in there and you can see the theatre.
So great.
It's incredible. If you ever come to visit Scotland, you must come and see it.
My wife is going to be doing a play at the Edinburgh Festival this summer.
Really?
So unless I'm tied up in Albuquerque, I'm going to come over there too. Anyways, I've never been to Scotland. So she, I believe, has been. I'm not sure. But she's going to be doing a play called Hamlet in Bed there, which is a play that she did in New York last year. So hopefully get a chance to come over and see y'all.
Oh, that's fantastic. Please do let me know, Michael, if you do come over. And I'll take you to see the theatre and a few other little bits and bobs related to Laurel and Hardy. I'll also come and see the show.
Excellent.
Now, what aspect of Laurel and Hardy's comedy appeals to you? Would it be the slapstick, the visual comedy, or would it be the one-liners? Because there was some really... I think they were ahead of their time when it came to one-liners. Stan came up with some crackers, didn't he?
Absolutely. But you know what? It's so funny. It was really the only time, I think, that the transition from silent to sound was made that perfectly, because their voices and the timbre of their voices and the way they spoke, it matched the physical so perfectly. You couldn't have cast better voices for those guys. Their persona, you could almost hear them in the silent films. That's how it seemed. And, you know, I think the thing that I really love the most, if push comes to shove, that I most loved about Laurel and Hardy was that they really, really loved each other. That as exasperating as they were, as big a fool as Stan could be, Ollie didn't drop him. Mm. He didn't say, I'm going to need another partner, you know? And even when they were married, they were always married to sort of beautiful nightmare women, you know? And it's sort of, well, we don't know how you pull that off. But they didn't seem to, they seemed so much happier in each other's company. And there was just something kind of absurd about that. And, but it really is the fact that they kind of felt about each other the way you have to feel about the world in general. It's like, this is not working at all, but it's what we're stuck with. We're going to stick with this.
And that's why they appealed to a worldwide audience as well, because everybody could relate to them. Now, did you ever meet or work with anyone who knew Stan? Like, for instance, Dick Van Dyke or Jerry Lewis knew Stan as well?
No, I knew some people. When I was growing up, there was people who were my age, you know, in their teens and 20s, who had visited Stan or who had, you know, spoken on the phone or you know, communicated with him. I never met him. But I did work, well, actually I didn't work with him, but there was a director of photography named Kenneth Peach.
Uh-huh.
And Ken Peach shot a lot of Laurel and Hardy's films, a lot of the shorts, some of the features. And he was toward the end of his career, toward the end of his life, you know, a healthy director of photography lasts forever. You know, because they work with the brain.
Sure.
I met Ken Peach several times when he was shooting Mork and Mindy, and we were doing Laverne and Shirley on the same lot at Paramount. So I actually talked with Ken for a little bit about working with those guys, and you know, he just said it was a really fun set, you know, and you don't see many like that. So it was nice to hear that.
When we spoke to Mark Hamill on the show, he was telling us some of the stories that Peter Cushing would tell him, you know, about working with Laurel and Hardy on A Chump at Oxford.
Right.
And he told Mark how Stan would just do everything, you know, on set, and Ollie would just go to the golf and, you know, take off as soon as he'd finished filming. Stan would just take control. So it must have been great to see that actually happening. And so much of it, so many supporting actors. Robert Mitchum was in a Laurel and Hardy film. Did you know that?
That's I sort of think I knew that.
Dancing Masters was the movie that he was in. It was one of the Fox ones, one of the later ones.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a favourite foil, Michael, from the movies? I think most people like James Finlayson as the foil. For some people, it's Charlie Hall or Charles Middleton.
Yeah, Charlie was pretty great. I mean, he had a lovely slow burn. I mean, Finlayson was more explosive.
Mm.
But Charlie, I always thought that he he just kind of stood there and took the abuse because he was thinking up his response. Edgar Kennedy too.
Edgar Kennedy, of course.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I really loved him. Yeah, I was a big fan of all the Hal Roach stuff.
Now, just before we let you go, Michael, if you could have appeared in any Laurel and Hardy film, which one would it have been?
The thing is, the casting is so tight. They didn't have a lot. Even in Sons of the Desert, where they have crowds of folks, there is still that little tight body of you know. I couldn't imagine stepping into Charlie Chase's shoes in that film. But that's a great part. The guy who knows how to have a good time, and there are these two struggling fools who are just trying like crazy to have a good time. I'd want to be anywhere with them, you know. I could picture myself in the Foreign Legion. You know, that would have been fun. Yeah, I don't know. I would have taken anything.
Yeah.
I would have shaved my head to work with Laurel and Hardy.
Now, when we spoke to Ricky Gervais on the show, he told us that Christopher Guest is a big Laurel and Hardy fan as well. When you guys were doing Spinal Tap, did you often watch Laurel and Hardy when you were on the road, on tour?
You know what? It's more like we would watch individually and compare notes.
Sure.
Yeah, they had a release some of the shorts and, you know, some stuff that they just dug up and, you know, mismatched prints. And so they had a showing of them at a local theater here in Santa Monica. And I took my kids to see that. And then years later, when Chris's son, Tom, was, you know, 6-7 years old, they began, he put him on the road to Laurel and Hardy Land. And you know what? It's like, I think if you have a soul, you belong with the Sons of the Desert. You know, there's something about them that's different than everybody else. And there, listen, I love Buster Keaton. I like a lot of Harold Lloyd stuff. You know, there are other performers, other comedy performers that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about those two guys that it was just different. It was kind of more about us somehow.
Yeah, well, we're doing this show to try and to encourage people to introduce them to the next generation, because they deserve to be remembered. And so by you coming on the show today, you're helping with that. And we really thank you for doing that for us and for giving us your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Michael McKean, thank you very much. All the best with Better Call Saul when it comes back, and all the best with the rest of your career.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Black Sky Radio.
Okay, we're going to play Michael out now with one of the songs he sang, and this is Spinal Tap. This is Gimme Some Money.
Stop wasting my time. You know what I want. You know what I need. Oh, maybe you don't. Do I have to come right flat out and tell you everything? Give me some money. Give me some money. I'm nobody's fool. I'm nobody's clown. I'm treating you cool. I'm putting you down. But baby, I don't intend to leave empty-handed. Give me some money. Give me some money. Oh yeah. Go, Nigel, go.
treating me right.
Give me some money.
Your face is okay, but your purse is too tight.
Give me some money.
I'm looking for pound notes, loose change, bad checks, anything.
Give me some money.
Coming up next, I'm going to be speaking to Scottish actor and writer Alex Norton. Alex wrote a play called Stan's First Night, which was based on Stan Laurel's first performance when he was a teenager at the Britannia Music Hall Theatre, the Panopticon, and Alex will be telling us all about that after this message from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Paul Woodedge, D-Day historian, a battlefield tour guide in Normandy, France. I offer tours of the D-Day landing beaches of 1944, along with my partner Magali. If you would like to find out more, see my website at www.ddayhistorian.com and my partner Magali's at www.ddayforyou.com. I am proud to be supporting the Ross Owen Show.
Black Sky Radio.
And joining me now, the writer of Stan's First Night, actor Alex Norton. Alex, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, the first thing I want to ask you is, how did you first discover Laurel and Hardy and what appealed to you about them?
You know, it's so long ago, I can't remember how I first knew about them. It must have been from the telly. We had a telly when we lived in the Gorbals in the 50s. I think we probably were the first in the street to get one. But they used to show old, kind of comedies and clips on the telly. And it must have been from there that I saw Laurel and Hardy. I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't love Laurel and Hardy. You know what I mean? It goes back that far. I can't remember not knowing about them. And I also knew about them from Film Fun magazine. My Uncle Willie Douglas used to get Film Fun regularly, and they had their own sort of comic strip in it. And from that and from telly clips, I just grew up with Laurel and Hardy.
Now, Stan's first stage performance was at the Britannia Panopticon Theatre in Glasgow. Mm. Didn't you have a part to play in that theatre being rediscovered?
Well, I did. I have an uncle. The only kind of show business connection that I have, because I just came from a sort of fairly ordinary working class Glasgow background. My dad was a plumber. And, sometimes I wonder where the kind of the showbiz thing came from. You know, why did I want to go on stage? And I don't know whether these things are in the genes or not. But I had a great uncle, Uncle Billy, who I discovered had been on the halls. He was a variety performer. And he played the Panopticon. And I only really met him once. And I was talking to him. He was an old folks home at Crookston. And he said, I was saying, where did you play and all that? He said, I played the Royal Princesses. That was became the Citizens Theatre. And he said, I used to play the Panopticon regularly. I said, the Panopticon? He said, aye. He said, Picker's old place, the Pots and Pans, we used to call it. And he said, as far as I know, it's still there. It's somewhere in Argyle Street, near the Tron Gate. And so it just stayed with me that for years. And Bill Patterson, my pal Bill, who's also an enthusiast about sort of Glasgow and Scottish variety, one day I said to him, why don't we go and see if we can find the Panopticon? He said, my old Uncle Billy said he thinks it's still there. He said he thought it was above a shoe shop. So Bill and I set out one day and we walked in Argyle Street and we walked down towards the Tron, going into sort of every shop and saying, have you got an old theatre upstairs? You got some odd responses. But eventually we came to the shoe shop and we went in and said, this sounded like a daft question, but you don't happen to have an old theatre up the stairs, do you? And so the guy said, aye. He said, aye, the old Panopticon. He said, it's upstairs. He said, do you want to see it? He said, oh, yeah.
Wow.
So he took us up the back stairs and we walked through this door and picked our way across sort of bits of rubble and things like that, and found ourselves standing halfway up the stage because they'd built a sort of toilet block thing on the stage. We were halfway up the stage looking out under the proscenium arch along the gallery. of the Panopticon. And it was like, I mean, for me, it was like Howard Carter discovering Tutankhamun's tomb. You know, it was like Indiana Jones.
There was this
gem, this jewel of a forgotten theatre in Glasgow. So we started up a campaign. We tried to raise money, and we got various, kind of bodies involved to start a charity and all that stuff. But most folk realized it was going to be a long haul and involve committees and meetings and all regular meetings and all that sort of thing and fundraising. People just sort of dropped off really and weren't interested in getting that involved in it. So it kind of came to nothing. Mm-hmm. But we did get some publicity, and it was in the papers. The Herald did a big piece about it and all that. So I think it kind of, if nothing else, if it triggered somebody else to think, oh, there's something worth pursuing. Because now you've got, the people who are running it now, and particularly, Judith Bowers, who's doing it, putting in all the hours God sends to get the place done.
Yes.
And it's still a long way from completion, but at least, they've done a hell of a lot more than Billy and I managed to do. They've got a new roof, and it's all been sort of done up on the outside and all that sort of thing. So it may have sparked somebody to inspire them to follow on where we had to sort of drop off. And it was a great regret to me, because I kind of thought, this is what I'm meant to do. I had one of those sort of feelings. And this is meant to be my destiny, is to restore this faded jewel in the middle of Glasgow.
When you first came across the Panopticon with Bill that day, did you know about Stan Laurel's history there at that point?
Yes, I did, because I'd been a great fan of Laurel and Hardy, and particularly Stan Laurel. I'd read a couple of biographies about them.
Sure.
And it said, that Stan had mentioned getting his start at Pickard's in Glasgow. So I did know that. And that fired when we actually found the place. And I thought, I'm standing on the spot where Stan Laurel stood when he was 16, looking out at that audience. And knowing what it's like as a young actor to be standing in the wings, waiting to go on. Mm. And the butterflies and the sort of terrors of that await you. I thought I could write a wee piece about this.
So that triggered the idea for the play being in that.
That's where I got the idea from, yeah. So when I got commissioned, I'd already written a play for the Dramarama series for STV called Waiting for Elvis, about Elvis Presley turning up at Prestwick Airport in 1960.
Oh, yes.
And it was very successful. It won that Silver Medal Award at the New York Film and Television Awards. So they asked me to do another one. And immediately that sprang to mind. I thought, this is it. This is the chance to get Stan's act on, recreate Stan's act at the Panopticon. So I sat and I wrote Stan's First Night. And it was wonderful. I mean, I just loved it. I loved recreating Stan's act. I mean, I've no idea what it was like. There's no written record of what his act actually was, but I just took a few clues that he'd written about and kind of fleshed it out from there.
I think it's brilliant. I've watched it, Stan's First Night, and I think it's absolutely brilliant, and every Laurel and Hardy fan should see it. Do you have any plans to reinvent it?
I have for a long time. I've always wanted to do it as a stage show, and I'd love to do it at the Panopticon. But I guess it's just really me getting off my jacksy and turning it into a stage show, and getting in touch with Judith to say, what can we go ahead with this?
Well, you should definitely do it. I think there's definitely an audience, because the Sons of the Desert have their meetings in the Panopticon once a month where they show the films as well. And they're always jam-packed full, always. So there's definitely an audience for it. Now, what's your opinion of the biopic that's coming up?
Which one's that?
Do you not know about this?
I don't think I do.
Some people are dubious about a biography about Laurel and Hardy, but I think it's the only one that hasn't been done. There's been so many done about other acts, like the Three Stooges and different other biographies. This one is going to be set.
There was a dismal thing I saw once on the telly. It really made me kind of ashamed to watch it. The New Adventures of Laurel and Hardy.
That's
with a guy that I'd worked with called Bronson Pinchot.
Yes. That's
who
right.
Who played Stan in it.
Yes.
And it, we'd worked together in a film called Blame It on the Bellboy in Venice. And he's a lovely guy.
Of course, he was in the Eddie Murphy movies, wasn't he? He was in all the Beverly Hills Cops.
That's right. That's him. That's the guy. Yeah.
Sergi.
But it was just appalling. It was just one of those, it was a series, I think. It didn't last very long. I think they made maybe two series of it and then realised it was a turkey.
Because they played Laurel and Hardy's nephews, and I think what they tried to do is recreate Laurel and Hardy, which is not the way to go. Because if you're going to play an icon, you've got to get it right, or the fans will come down on you.
And the saddest thing about it was, it just wasn't funny.
No, the plot wasn't
Laurel
a great
plot. Laurel and Hardy
plot.
Are just brilliant comedians.
Mm-hmm.
And these two guys, you know, giving it their all, I'm sure, but it just wasn't funny. The scripts weren't funny. And they just got it completely and utterly wrong. They couldn't have got it more wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was. I'm so glad they didn't carry on with it.
Well, we've got the biopic is going to be set in 1953 at the end of the 1953 tour, and it's going to be focusing on the relationship. And I believe there will be flashback scenes and what have you. It's going to be a really, really interesting project, and I'm really looking forward to it. But Alex, thanks again for your time today. Thanks for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. It always is a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for asking me. Any chance to talk about Laurel and Hardy, I'm there.
Good luck in the future with any future production of Stan's First Night. Let me know if you're going to do anything about it, and we'll get the word out there, and I'll be first in the queue to see it.
You'll be the first to know.
Thanks, Alex.
All right, Ross. Bye, Dave.
Black Sky Radio.
Now, earlier in the show, when we spoke to Ricky Gervais, I mentioned a website called lettersfromstan.com. It's a fascinating website which was created by Bernie Hoje, who's joining me on the phone now from New York. Welcome to the show, Bernie.
Thanks, Ross. Glad to be here.
Now, Letters from Stan is one of my favourite websites. First of all, for the listeners who don't know, tell us what it's all about.
Well, let me give you the background. I've been a lifelong Laurel and Hardy fan. And when I was a kid, I collected autographs of classic comedians, because that's the area that I wanted to specialize in. And over the years, over the decades, whenever I would see letters from Stan Laurel, in auction catalogs or in various sales or different garage sales, I would get a copy of it. I would buy a letter. I have a few letters that I bought over the years, but I would save copies of the letters. And so spring ahead to 10 years ago, I was on the internet and I just happened to find a website that cataloged the letters of Mark Twain, the famous American writer.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, wow, this is pretty fascinating. You know, all of Mark Twain's letters, and he was a prolific writer and prolific letter writer. And so I thought, this is kind of interesting. I wonder if there's anything like this, you know, for other people on the internet. And I found out that, yes, there was. There was, in fact, an archive of the letters of Abraham Lincoln, an archive of the letters of Albert Einstein, and an archive of the letters of Thomas Jefferson. And I thought to myself, well, why not Stan Laurel? Stan Laurel was a prolific letter writer like those other gentlemen. And so I decided to start this website. The URL is lettersfromstan.com. The kind of official title I gave it is the Stan Laurel Correspondence Archive Project, because I wanted the people to know that it is a project.
Uh-huh.
And I started off with maybe a couple of hundred letters. I decided that the interesting thing about that would be to transcribe them, not just publish the pictures of the letters, but actually transcribe them so that the content would be searchable. And then something really fascinating happened that I didn't really foresee. And that is, as I started to put the letters together in chronological order, for the first time ever, outside of Stan's typewriter, an interesting thing happened where you actually could track, you know, Stan's entire life through his letter writing.
Mm.
And why that's interesting is because there are obviously dozens of books written about Laurel and Hardy. Importantly, maybe John McCabe's books, because John McCabe had lots of direct access to Stan in his later years. But even through that filter, every single thing you read about Stan Laurel is written through an author's perspective. So there might be a quote or two, but then the author goes and gives you his analysis of that,
uh-huh.
which is sometimes fair, sometimes unfair. You don't know, because we didn't know Stan and we weren't there when he was living his life. But the fascinating thing about the collection of letters is that for the first time ever, You have Stan's autobiography. Every single word that you read on lettersfromstan.com are the words that Stan Laurel wrote. So, for instance, you can go back to 1930. You can go back to the 30s and read letters of Laurel and Hardy's visit to the UK through Stan's eyes, exactly as he was living it, letters he wrote on stationery from the hotels they were staying at. And then you can read those same anecdotes that he would be telling about that trip when he was retired and living in Santa Monica in the 60s. So it's a really fascinating thing in that you get to learn about Stan's life. You get to feel a little bit more for his humanity, and you get to learn something about the craft of comedy, because he talks a lot about making the movies that Laurel and Hardy so famously made. And so I think that the website for me was an eye opener in a lot of ways. Now today, there are over 1,600 letters in the archive. And and not only letters, but also I've populated the website with various photographic material, newspaper articles that relate to the letters.
Sure.
As well as high resolution copies of the letters that exist. And the cool thing about it too is that you get to see like on any given day, let's say for instance, just pick a day, like you go August 2nd, 1945, and you could go in there and take a look at it and see that on that day Stan wrote five letters. And you can read all five letters that he sat down and wrote that day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the letters interlace with one another in a way that you would never be able to ever know had I not done all this painstaking, you know, transcription and research. And it's all done by hand, and it's all done by me, and it's all done out of love for Stan Laurel. So I hope people will go to it and take a look. There's a lot to be entertained by, but more importantly, I'm asking if anybody has letters from family members that Stan wrote to, or if they have letters that Stan wrote to themselves, or they have letters that they bought at auction, and it's not in the archive, to go to the lettersfromstan.com website and send me a copy of that letter so I can add it to the archive, and it could be part of this great historical, you know, perspective on Stan Laurel's life.
Absolutely. And there's, when Mark Hamill was on the show, we spoke about a letter from a letter to Stan from Alec Guinness, Sir Alec Guinness, where Sir Alec Guinness mentioned that he would love to meet Stan, and we're still trying to find out if he ever did meet Stan. We still don't know. But have you ever thought about adding letters to Stan?
Yeah, there are some of those as well, where I could find or whether I've been contacted by people who were the actual recipients of the letters. Sometimes they would send me copies of their letters that they sent to Stan that got a certain response. And
sure.
if you go to the website, there are various additional functions to each of the letters. When you find them, you can either click on an icon and see the picture of the letter, or you can click on notes from the editor, or you could also click on notes from the recipient of the letter. And very often in those notes from the recipient of the letter, I will actually put the entire transcription of the letter that Stan is responding to, because sometimes that's interesting too. I mean, this project will go forever as long as people, you know, continue to populate it with letters. But I think that's why Letters from Stan as a project is not a book, because a book ceases to continue once ink hits the paper. Letters from Stan is a website, because every day I can add something new to it, and it grows and grows and expands. And my hope is that one day, you know, I could donate this archive to some place where they can continue to populate it and cultivate it and curate it. And maybe it would be like, you know, one of the libraries in the United States that has the Hal Roach collection or something like that. But someplace where it lives on forever for fans and historians, you know, in the future.
Now, isn't there an archive in America of Stan Laurel's letters as well?
You know, I think that there was a donation of letters when John McCabe died that might have gone to a collection or to a museum.
Did you manage to get copies of those?
No, those I can't track down. I mean, there are a lot of others that I have tracked down, and you know, the nice thing about it is that the website is so, you know, gloriously you know, reviewed by various magazines and publications, mm-hmm. including mm-hmm. The Guardian, so people know about it, and I will get periodically calls and letters and emails from people who have large collections. Like just recently, in the past couple of months, I got a surprise email from Booth Coleman's brother. Booth Coleman was an actor.
From Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, he was in Planet of the Apes, but more importantly, he was a stage actor and was in probably hundreds of television shows before that. And he was also a very close friend of Stan Laurel's.
Right.
So when he passed away, he left his collection to his brother, and his brother very generously let me have copies of all of them all together in
fantastic.
One place.
Fantastic.
So Ross, you're talking about like, you know, a couple hundred letters that I could put into the archive. And the funny thing about it is that, you know, Stan Laurel was such a prolific letter writer, like I said. But he would write letters to little kids. He would write letters to famous fellow actors. And he would write letters to just the average Joe who happened to find his address. And every single letter that he wrote was written with complete respect and total candor by this great man. And with his close personal friends, he shared details of things that he may not share with someone who was just writing him a fan letter.
Sure.
So those Booth Coleman letters are really interesting to read. And you can go into the archive and you can search for various recipients' names. If you type in Booth Coleman, all of his letters will come up and you'll be able to read through them. And they're just as fascinating as the other letters at the archive. But you know, as you can tell, I'm very enthusiastic about the project because I love this guy. And I wish I had written a letter to him. I wish I had met him. It was as easy as looking his name up in the phone book. And from the people who were so lucky to do so, he would invite them over and they would come and have a tea with him and sit and talk. It's an amazing thing. And you know, I live vicariously through all of these people who were so lucky and so fortunate to have corresponded with Stan Laurel.
Sure. Now, which period of Stan's life does it cover from start to finish? Would you say that, I mean, obviously we don't know how long Stan's been writing letters, but how far back does it go?
Well, I'll tell you this, you know, the first letters in the archive, you know, are from the beginnings of his career. And, you know, like I said, it's a combination of letters and also documents. So in that very early period, there are a couple of letters that he wrote, and there are also some contracts that he signed, his very earliest contracts when he was beginning to move from vaudeville to film. It starts there and it goes all the way to the end of his life. And he of course, when he retired, he became a much more prolific letter writer as much as he, you know, had a lot more free time. But a fascinating quote of Stan's is that he loved letters so much, loved writing letters, and he loved the whole idea of letters so much that he once actually said that if he weren't a comedian, he would have loved to be a stationer to sell stationery because he loved stationery and letters.
Wow.
And you know, the great thing, and the cool thing about Stan Laurel's letters is he wrote on so many different types of stationery, and I think he got a kick out of designing new stationery.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you look through and if you see a little red envelope next to one of the letters, you click on it and you could see a picture of that letter. And some of the stationery that he used had colorful, you know, drawings of Laurel and Hardy. Other ones had really beautiful typography on his name. Like I said, if you could go to an individual day where he might have written five or six letters, they're not all written on the same stationery. He would choose a piece of paper out of his drawer for each recipient. And it's quite fascinating. Like I said, there's a lot to learn about Stan Laurel, and all of it is good. There are no skeletons in his closet. He was a generous, kind, amazing guy that was always willing to put himself on the line, help and give advice to, like I said, grade school kids. Imagine if you're a grade school kid today and you admire an actor and you write a letter. You think that letter would ever get to that person and that person would ever write you a personal response and give you advice on your career? When you're asking a question about a backyard, you know, skit that you're putting together, it's unheard of.
Is it because Stan wrote more letters than Ollie did that there exists more letters of from Stan than there does Ollie?
You know, that's an interesting question. You know, Oliver Hardy was not a letter writer. In fact, there are so very few letters of his that exist at all. I don't know whether it was partly due to his more humble and poorer family upbringing.
Right.
But he was not a letter writer. And, you know, in fact, the only letters that I've ever seen of Oliver Hardy's are either letters written by a secretary at Hal Roach Studios, where Ollie signs his name, or letters, personal letters. There was a little cache of personal letters and notes that he sent to his wife Myrtle back in the old days, and those were all handwritten little love notes, just basically offering his love and his affection to her, but very, very simple and very, very unburdened by needing to say too much. And so I think that, you know, in the matter of Laurel and Hardy, it seems that Ollie did his job, and he did it magnificently well, but he left the business of the team to Stan, not only, you know, the writing and the editing of the films,
sure,
but also the correspondence and the fan mail and all of that. And I think that Stan relished it, and he continued it, and it became one of his passions in retirement. I think that Stan Laurel would have been one of those people who would make you laugh every day. And in fact, a lot of his letters do contain jokes. He was always his comic mind was always spinning. And so one of his very, very dear friends and longtime correspondents was a fellow named Ernie Murphy.
Uh-huh.
And Ernie Murphy was, in the Hal Roach days, Stan's chauffeur. I think that he actually drove him around from his house to the studio.
Ah.
And they reconnected later on in life. I'm not sure exactly when, but sometime in the 50s. And every single one of Stan's letters to Ernie Murphy ends with a joke. It would always be like to your best friend, you'd be like, have you heard this one? And he'll give him a little joke. And some of them are racy, and some of them are political, but they're all joyful and fun. And like I said, there's a lot to discover in Stan Laurel's letters. And I think that what it does is it gives you a feeling about the man, more so the comedic genius. Because as a man, like I said, he seemed to have been just the sweetest, nicest, greatest guy. And I don't think you would ever hear a bad word about him. And his letters, where he is not, like I said, he's not self-editing. He doesn't know anybody's going to be reading these, you know, 80 years after he wrote them.
Uh-huh.
But every letter is so beautifully written, and every letter shows him to be a kind, sweet, caring guy.
Right. So like you said earlier, Letters from Stan, it really is like reading Stan's biography in his own words. You definitely should go and visit the site if you haven't already. It's one of those websites you'll keep going back to because it's constantly being updated. Bernie, thank you for giving us your time today. I'm so glad we managed to get you in time. Good luck with the website. Long may it continue to grow. And thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Russ, and lots of luck with the radio show. We've been correspondents for a very long time, and this is the first time I've heard your voice.
Well, we should do it again sometime. We'll get you back on in the future, and we'll talk more. Oh, wow. New York's busy today.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise here. But by the way, let me just say one more thing. Happy birthday, Stan Laurel.
Thank you very much, Bernie.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Black Sky Radio.
Joining me now on the phone is the lead singer of my favourite Scottish band, Travis. They're currently in the middle of a tour. Fran Healy is here with us. Fran, welcome to the show.
It's lovely to be on the show.
How's the tour going? You're still in Mexico?
We are in Mexico City right now, and the tour's great. We played two nights ago in Mexico City. We were in Guadalajara before that and Monterrey.
Now, but first of all, you live in Germany now, so I assume you know what Laurel and Hardy are called in Germany.
Of course, Dick and Doof.
Dick and Doof, well done.
Thick and stupid.
They've got so many different names in different countries, and I was delighted when I found out that you were a Laurel and Hardy fan. Where did the passion for the boys come from?
Well, when we were kids, they would show Laurel and Hardy all the time on BBC Two.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, like around about, I don't know, half five, it was kind of in the Harold Lloyd slot.
That's right.
On BBC Two. And so I sort of, and my granddad as well, it was his generation, so he was a massive Laurel and Hardy fan. And it was just part of your daily television sort of diet was, there's Laurel and Hardy. And they were, at that point, I think the funniest thing on telly, way better than all of the television that was on, you know, the box back then, and so I watched tons of it, and I've been a fan forever.
Now, people often say to me, when you're introducing Laurel and Hardy to kids of today, they think that they're going to be put off by the fact that they're in black and white. But what I keep telling people is, when we were younger, I'm from the same generation as you, when we were younger, TV was in colour. It didn't bother us that they were in black and white, so why should it bother kids now? Is it because there's big epic blockbusters in the cinemas now? And
well, a lot of kids freak out at black and white, but what they do is kind of beyond what colour it is, or what, black and white colour or whatever. I was just thinking there when you were talking, like, so when my granda turned me on to Laurel and Hardy, we would walk from Hamilton Hill, we'd walk down over the Forth and Clyde Canal, down towards what is now sort of the Cowcaddens area of Glasgow, and walk towards St George's Cross. And on the way to St George's Cross, there was a theatre, and we would pass that theatre, and my granda's like, Laurel from Laurel and Hardy worked in there when he was a young man. And this was true, because Laurel's father, I think, ran the theatre or something.
Yes, that's right, his father used to run theatres in Glasgow, and of course he wanted Stan to work in the theatre with him rather than on the stage, which led to Stan, as you know, it led to Stan stealing his dad's trousers, cutting them up to make some sort of costume. He turned up at the Panopticon, got himself a gig there, and his dad was in the audience and was horrified to see his trousers all cut up. But that was the big turning point for Stan. Now, what's the appeal of the Laurel and Hardy films for you? I mean, is it a slapstick? Is it the one-liners?
Well, as a kid, you just watch and they're funny. It's just, as a child, you watch it and it's funny. And not just funny, it's like deeply funny. It's got this thing about it that touches you sort of deeper than most stuff. And it's a combination of the choreography, the slapstick, the acting is brilliant, the deadpanning directly to the screen, that suddenly removes the fourth wall. But you don't know all these things when you're a kid. You're just laughing because it's incredibly funny on one level, on the surface. But then as you get older, you start to appreciate how brilliantly written it was. And then, you know, with the internet, you start to read about Laurel and what a genius he was. Mm-hmm. And I think he was kind of like he sort of lived in the shadow of Chaplin a little bit. He was his understudy, I believe, at one point. And he sort of lived in that shadow. But in a weird way, I feel Stan was way funnier. I think by living in the shadow, he got to develop some other sort of style of physical comedy. Mm-hmm. And he sort of, it took him ages, it would seem, to actually get a break and to find his lifelong partner in Babe.
Yeah, and it worked out incredibly well for them in the end. Now, as a songwriter, have you ever paid homage to Laurel and Hardy within one of your songs?
No, never. I haven't paid homage to them ever, but the interesting thing is, like, when I had my own son, we don't watch a lot of telly in the house because it's just rubbish. Mm-hmm. I would, because of YouTube, you could watch, you know, like little things. So I would, when he was really small, I would show him Ivor the Engine. That was his first telly, and he loved that. And then he went on to Button Moon, and then Inspector Gadget. And then one day I was watching a Laurel and Hardy thing, and he came up and he's like, "What's this?" And I was like, "Oh, it's Laurel and Hardy," and I did the old, "It's in black and white, you might not like it." And he sat and he just loved it. And so, and I had the box set, you know, with all of the Laurel and Hardys, and he just ate the whole thing. He's seen more Laurel and Hardy than I have.
Wow. How old is he now?
He's 10 now, and this is when he was like 7 or 8, right, which I think can only be a good thing for him to be seeing such
absolutely
brilliant stuff.
Because, I mean, this is one of the questions and one of the things we're talking about is, do you think it's important that we keep the memory of Laurel and Hardy alive for future generations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, I think it's our job as fathers and as you know, grown-ups to mm-hmm. just pass it on. And I think if something is great, then it will be easy to pass on and it will stay around forever. And you'll find, I mean, nowadays, Laurel and Hardy, I mean, I believe it was something to do with the licensing of those two, is it a two-reeler? Yeah, it was a two-reeler. Opened it up so they were allowed to show it on telly, loads on TV in the 70s and 80s, and they actually got that a sort of they had a sort of comeback when they, you know, they were all dead by that point, and that's when I started to see it, you know, in the 80s when I was a kid,
the big revival.
And I think the thing is, if something is that good, it won't ever go away, because it endures, because there's something about it that's timeless. And I think we don't need to worry, actually. I mean, as long as the grown-ups pass it on to the next generation, because mm-hmm. funny is funny, and I really don't think you can get much funnier than Laurel and Hardy.
I think you nailed it. You know, funny is funny and slapstick is timeless. Now, Laurel and Hardy made it to number two in the charts with Trail of the Lonesome Pine. Can you remember who kept him off the number one spot? Do you know?
I have no idea.
I'll give you a clue. Okay, Laurel and Hardy were number two in the charts in 1975. 75. And the song that kept them off the charts was a massive, massive hit. A classic.
ABBA? No, it wasn't ABBA. Was it ABBA?
It was Queen.
Queen with what?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh my God, that's crazy that Queen were at number one and Laurel and Hardy were at number two.
Aye, the Queen kept, Bohemian Rhapsody kept Laurel and Hardy off the number one spot back in 1975. And it was thanks to John Peel that they got on the charts in the first place, because he kept playing them on his show.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So, that's fantastic.
I didn't know he was a fan.
Oh, massive fan. And Ken Bruce, who's now doing basically the same show, is also a fan. So maybe we should get Ken Bruce to start playing it, and maybe we can get it back to number one. We'll do one of those mad internet campaigns to get them back to stop X Factor again or something. I don't know. But
The thing, going back to my son, we did a bit of a pilgrimage, and we went to LA, and we went to the bottom of the, we walked the music box steps.
Oh, I've been there. It's fantastic, isn't it? An experience.
It's amazing, because it hasn't changed. I mean, the buildings around it, but there's the steps. There's the, you know, and it's night, you know, you feel if these guys were here, they were just like standing here and we're standing here, and it was a total.
That's all I could think about when I was there. And of course, you have to go up them, don't you? You have to take that walk up and down the stairs. And it's an incredible experience. But now, my final question to you, Fran, is do you have a favourite Laurel and Hardy movie, or do you have any favourite scenes?
There's the whole... It's a really... when they're in the sawmill, is it Busy Bodies, or is it...
That's the one.
No, it's... Is it?
Yeah.
The whole thing is, I think it's like a masterpiece, just the way it builds mm-hmm. to that final climax. And there's that from the it's all kind of just building blocks up to the point where he gets he sits him down in the chair and he's got the brush. Bristles on his chin, and that whole, from the moment he sits him down and starts to soap him up with the thing, and him looking at the camera, and then he planes off the bristles.
Yeah, yeah.
Going through the tubes.
Yes, thing, yes,
and
it, yes.
It's caught, and then the sort of fan starts to hit his bum. It's like, there's a whole, it's maybe about a minute long, or maybe more. But it's kind of flawless.
And there's that great line in it. Why, that's a blueprint of the Boulder Dam.
Yeah. There's so much. There's also that really, it, 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 it kind of annoyed me a little bit, but the This Is Your Life.
Oh, that was horrible because it was live and Stan didn't want to do it.
And they had them there on like false pretenses that they were going to get a film deal and things.
Yeah, that's horrible, isn't it?
And it's because every artist, you know, you make your art and you want some validation, and especially if you've kind of you've had the back has been turned on you and you found out that, you know, you go to Britain and you realize, oh my God, we're people love us as it should be. Mm-hmm. And then they do this to them. I thought, oh my God, it's one of the most humiliating things. It's a terrible thing to see.
Stan was a consummate professional. He always liked to prepare things before he did them. So for that, yeah. You'll notice when you watch it, Stan doesn't say very much at all. And it's very awkward, isn't it, to watch? It's very difficult to watch. The presenter just, I thought he was rude to Oliver Hardy at times, calling him fat and things like that.
I know, it was awful. But I was just remembering another another thing that I found funny. I don't know why it always sticks in my head, but I can't remember the name of the film, but when they work in the horn factory.
Oh yeah, that's Saps at Sea.
Saps at Sea. Right.
Hornophobia.
Horns to the left of me.
That was James Finlayson's last Laurel and Hardy film.
Yeah, the wee guy that did the brilliant double takes.
That's him, yeah.
So there's a line in that one that is that just stays with me, was when they're on the boat, they finally get on the boat and there's a goat because they've been told he's got to drink goat milk.
Narcissus is the name of the goat.
Narcissus, what's its name? Narcissus. I mean, come on. It's like, you know, the really, really super, super clever and really sort of, and probably lost on so many people, but it didn't really matter. But I think that's what makes them special. I mean, I just love them so much. I mean, I could talk about them all day, so, yeah.
Well, Fran, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about Laurel and Hardy, because I know you're very busy at the moment. But good luck with the forthcoming gigs, especially Glastonbury as well. You got that coming up. And Tea in the Park as well. You're coming home
Tea
for that.
Tea in the Park. That's good. For us, that's the one. You know, it's Tea in the Park is the always been our festival. We played at the first one, and so can't wait.
Thanks again for helping us keep the memory of Laurel and Hardy alive.
Nice one, Ross. Cheers, mate.
All the best, Fran.
See you, man.
Cheers, bye. Black Sky Radio. My final guest on the show is an American director, screenwriter and stand-up comic. He's best known as the creator of Meet the Parents and Relative Strangers. He is, of course, Greg Gliena, and he's joining me now on the phone. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Laurel and Hardy were probably most popular for their short films. Meet the Parents started as a short film, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I made it as about a 5-minute silent short where a guy goes to meet his girlfriend's parents and he ends up breaking this vase. And, I had an idea for turning it into a feature. I told my friend Emo Phillips, who's a famous comedian.
And oh, yes.
He said, he thought it was a funny idea. And if he told me to write the script and if he liked it, he would consider putting money into it. And that's what happened.
Right.
But it was inspired by my love for Laurel and Hardy and for the silent comedians. I was attempting to make essentially a silent movie that had dialogue, which is what I love about Laurel and Hardy. They have dialogue, but there's no jokes.
Yes.
You know, they say funny things, but they don't know what's funny. They don't mean to be funny. And that's something I love, and that's been a big influence on me.
I like to think of them as the original Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, exactly. But they never tried to be funny. They're always deadly serious.
That's true. And what was your first introduction to Laurel and Hardy?
Yeah, I loved him as a child. I don't even remember when the first time I saw him. I loved him. And I think Babes in Toyland or March of the Wooden Soldiers was my favorite when I was a kid. But it's funny, some stuff I loved as a child, like the Three Stooges or the Bowery Boys, that now I enjoy for more nostalgic reasons, but I don't really find them funny anymore. But Laurel and Hardy, I loved as a child, and I loved to this day. They had a style that has been an influence on me. I call it mock tragedy, where it's done very seriously like a tragedy, but it's funny. You know, they did that frequently in their films.
That was my next question. Do you think comedy needs that element of tragedy?
Oh, I think so. But it wasn't really tragedy. You didn't feel sad. It was funny, but it's like making fun of tragedy almost.
Mm-hmm.
One example is that scene in Their First Mistake. They adopt a baby, and then Stan wants to leave, and Ollie's like, "How could you leave me with this child?" And it's played so straight, but it's funny, you know.
Yeah.
Or the ending of Helpmates, where Ollie's, you know, house is destroyed, and he's sitting there. I'd like to be alone, and it rained. You know, it's just it's like mock tragedy.
Sure, sure. Now, why do you think we should keep their memory alive? Why do you think it's important?
Well, obviously, because they're funny. And they had a totally unique style. I mean, nobody did what they were doing. And I see elements of it all over the place. I mean, I remember reading that the Coen brothers are big Laurel and Hardy fans. And that made total sense. I love The Big Lebowski. I think it's one of the funniest comedies of recent years. And it's so full of Laurel and Hardy stuff. Like, for instance, when John Goodman throws the ashes into the wind, and then it just cuts to Jeff Goldblum with a straight face, all covered with the ashes. Totally Laurel and Hardy. They had just a very unique style that no one else of the 30s was doing that. Not the Marx Brothers or Wheeler and Woolsey or anyone else. It was totally, and it's timeless. I don't think they're of their time. I think they're just timeless. And it's, you know, when I grew up, I was probably the last generation that they were always on TV, these films. But now they're not. You know, you have to go to Turner Classic Movies at certain times to watch them. And I think if kids see them, they'll like them. You know, my sister showed, when my nephew and nieces were young, they showed them Babes in Toyland, and they loved it, you know?
Yeah.
I think they just, they need to be exposed, but the films are timeless. I mean, they're still funny.
You mentioned a couple of scenes from Laurel and Hardy, but do you have one particular favorite movie or scene that stands out from the rest?
Oh, this, you know, so much. I think my favorite short is Below Zero, because it's so bleak, you know. But I love, you know, I really love their stuff from the early 30s. I think that was their peak. I love Scram and Going Bye Bye, and I like whatever I'm watching at the time. But those, I think, Below Zero is my favorite for some reason.
Well, just one more question. Why do you think they survived the transition from silent to sound?
I think they're practically the only silent comedians who just didn't do anything different. And plus, they were slow to begin with. They weren't the fast-paced, speed-up-the-camera kind of slapstick. They were leisurely paced at the time, which is better for sound. But I think they didn't do anything different. They just added sound.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't add jokes. You know, if you see like the Harold Lloyd's early talking films, he's doing puns and wisecracks, and they just did what they did. They could remake their silent shorts exactly, and it didn't change anything.
What's on the horizon now for yourself?
Oh, I have a script that's going out to Jim Carrey. I'm just, you know, plugging around. I wrote a TV pilot that we may be just shooting as just ourselves, just as a kind of a demo.
Mm-hmm.
But just always writing, and I do some music gigs around Los Angeles, playing the piano and singing.
Greg, I just want to say thanks for taking the time to call in today. I know you're a very busy man. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I wish you all the best with all your future projects.
Thank you, and to you too.
Black Sky Radio.
Well, that brings us to the end of what I can only describe as being an epic show. Thank you to all my guests today, and thanks to you for listening from around the world. On tomorrow's show, I'll be chatting to Sheila Ferguson, former lead singer of the 3 Degrees. Plus, I'll be talking to the original Chicken George from Roots. Ben Vereen will be joining us, so be sure to tune in. My thanks again to all my guests today, and to you for tuning in to this special edition of the Ross Owen Show. Happy birthday, Stan.
The Ross Owen Show is sponsored by DDayHistorian.com.
Black Sky Radio.